Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome everyone, welcome, welcome. Well, my second guest today has the kind of lifestyle that you might look at and think, how does she get to do what she does? And the answer is, it is because it is who she is. For the past 30 years, Julia Whitty has been a scientist, documentary filmmaker, writer, and deep sea diver. She's currently an environmental correspondent with Mother Jones. And she's going to join us today around 12:25 to talk about her work as an environmental writer, and in particular, what's happening with our ocean today, with that intimate ecology? There's a lot going on, and what do we need to know and what can we do about it? But first, if you are feeling more anxious than normal lately, you're definitely not alone. Studies show that anxiety has been on the increase over the past couple of years. Surprise, surprise. And my first guest has four simple steps to help us overcome worry to create the life we want. My guest is Dr. Tamar Chansky. She's a clinical psychologist and is one of the nation's leading experts on anxiety disorders. She's the acclaimed author of several books, including Freeing Your Child from Anxiety, and she's the founder and director of the Children's and Adult Center for OCD and Anxiety. Dr. Chansky's new book is called Freeing Yourself from Anxiety. Dr. Chansky, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
Well, this is a really interesting book, and I think for anybody suffering from anxiety, whether it's a fairly regular condition for them to be in or a periodic one, you know, maybe somebody's got a big presentation coming up or something that's just causing them angst, there are some great tools and resources in this book. So tell us who you wrote this for and why you wrote it.
Yeah, you know, that's a really a good place to start, Vicki, because in the past, this is my fourth book, and the previous books were for parents of kids with an anxiety disorder. And what I realized just as time is going on and the stresses that we just live with day to day just keep inching their way up, the pace of our culture and all the demands. And so I wanted to make available the tools that I was using with my patients for everybody, for people with everyday worry and doubt, so that they could spend more time planning and preparing for their life rather than being scared and you know, procrastinating or getting really stressed out about it.
Yeah, I love that you say if we're constantly worrying, we're off track.
Exactly. Right. We, you know, if you think about any of us, if we just think about, you know, what were we worried about last week or yesterday? How did we solve that problem? It didn't come from worrying. It was what we were able to think clearly about when we could finally quiet the worry down. So sort of the shorter we make that trip or that detour, the better off we'll be.
So let's, for the purposes of this segment, Dr. Chansky, let's define what you mean by anxiety.
Sure. So, you know, we all know what stress is. If we have, you know, more things than we feel prepared to do, or we're all packed up to leave for the night after a long day's work, and then the boss comes in and says, I just need one more thing. And, you know, that's a moment of potential stress.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety, so that's one problem, let's say, but anxiety is the extra layer. It's the interpretations of that, the apprehension, you know, the running, racing ahead with the, you know, catastrophic worst-case scenarios. Oh, my gosh, if I don't do this, I'm going to lose my job. What's my boss going to think? What's my wife going to think? What have we done? We all do it. We all do it. It's a knee-jerk first reaction. But it basically doubles the problem because we still have to decide what we're going to do about the question of that work. But then we spend all of this anguish and time entertaining these other scenarios that really aren't about what's going on in the moment. And that's really, that's anxiety, is that extra layer of apprehension that just really, it doesn't serve us well.
Right. And we're hearing all the time, every day there are new studies coming out on the neuroplasticity of the brain, which is great news because it means we can change our behavior and our thinking patterns. You talk about something, you say the breakthrough focus is on possible thinking rather than positive thinking. Just talk a little bit about that before we go to break, if you would.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, there's a cartoon that someone told me about where a character looks very stressed, and then there's a poster above his head that says "Be happy," and the what's in the thought bubble of the character is "More pressure," which I just think is great. That we may think, we may have this idea that, you know, if we were normal, that normal people think positively all the time, but that's really not the case at all. Studies have shown that. So when we're feeling really stressed and in a corner, we don't need to do that far reach for, you know, everything's rosy in my life. We just need to know that there are options about how to get out of that corner. And that's what I mean when I say that the opposite of negative thinking isn't positive thinking, it's possible thinking.
Mm. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to take a look at the four steps. You call it a master plan for overcoming anxious thinking to create the life you want. And my guest in this segment is Dr. Tamar Chansky. Her book is called Freeing Yourself from Anxiety. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
High anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
For the people, by the people. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
High anxiety. It's always the same. Anxiety.
And welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Tamar Chansky, Dr. Tamar Chansky, and her new book. This is a great book, Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. And this is really well put together. And I was saying during the break that in most of the chapters, there's a section, a very small section called Bottleneck Beliefs, and then Better Beliefs, ways that you can turn your thought around. And I love the way you've put that together, Dr. Chansky.
Oh, thank you.
So I want to talk about the four steps. And obviously, we can't go into great detail. We've got about 12, 13 minutes here. But if we can start looking at each one of the four steps and taking a high-level look. And step one is You say pause and relabel. Don't believe everything we think. Talk about that a little, if you would.
Yeah, exactly. So this can be such a powerful step. You know, what happens with worry is as soon as we hear it, it has a great PR campaign, is the way I think about it, that it uses words and sort of an authority with its voice. You know, disaster, humiliation. It's not the kind of thing you can just turn away from right away, right?
Right.
It really grabs our attention. But if we know that it's coming from this, again, universal sort of knee-jerk reaction that we were wired in a time when we needed to overreact, we needed to mobilize because we were going to get eaten by a tiger if we didn't.
Right.
But the kind of threats we have today are, you know, generally not of that nature. And so if we can stamp or relabel the, you know, put a different caption or a different tag to the voice, think of it as, you know, it's your panic button got pushed, but then what you want to call for instead is your voice of reason. It just really helps to immediately take down the significance of that message. I think of it as going from having Anthony Hopkins tell you about your life versus Adam Sandler. I would be afraid if Anthony Hopkins said anything to me. I think so. You know, it just, right, because worry is not an authority. It definitely runs us around, but in the end, it's not our wisdom. It doesn't really know. You know, it just always says the same thing.
Right.
Yours sounds like mine, sounds like someone else's.
Right.
It's just that knee-jerk reaction.
Right. I love that you say it's renting space in your head. So we want to reclaim that rent space in our head. Step number two, get specific, you say. Narrow down the problem to one thing that really matters. Because often we get all bent out of shape over something that is not the real issue, don't we?
Right. We start so big. This is the thing, is that, you know, what happens when something goes wrong is we think, I've let everybody down, or I know nothing about this, or everything, you know, it's all the absolutes. It's so big. And if we ran around trying to solve that problem, I don't know, you know, we wouldn't get very far. So if we, there's an Albert Einstein quote, he said something like, if I had an hour to save the world, I'd spend 55 minutes defining the problem and 5 minutes on the solution. And I just think that if we ourselves don't just stop at that first reaction of everything, but really try to narrow it down, you know, it might come down to, you know, I need to write down messages so I remember to call people. Wow, that is so much more doable than, you know, I've let everyone down in my life and I'm a total failure. You know, if you had to choose door number one or door number two, you know, I think we would all make a good choice.
Right.
So it's really about taking the time to really hone in on what the issue at hand is.
Right. And talking of doors, I locked myself out at the weekend, so I caused my own set of anxiety there by picking
right.
up, by not being paying attention to which keys I picked up, you know.
And now I don't know how you react to that. You may be healthier than I am, Vicki, a little bit. Let's hope, right? But, you know, oftentimes, what do we do when something like that happens?
We go, we're so stupid, we're so dumb,
right?
What
you know,
an idiot.
Like, oh my gosh, my entire life is
I
out
never
of control.
Do anything right.
So if we just brought it down to, and this happened to me too. You got to put that spare key out in the backyard. You know, it's just one little thing that you got to take care of.
Well, I actually had one at one point hidden somewhere, and I had to climb a 6-foot fence to get to it. And then I thought, oh no, it's in my wallet that's inside the house. I'd moved it. But anyway, we do create our own anxiety a lot of the times. So step number three is optimize, and you say rethink what's possible and broaden your choices.
Right. So in step two, the pause was about narrowing down the problem to one thing that's wrong. And step three is really the opposite. It's giving ourselves room to consider different options. It's like a pull-down menu. I think of it as browsing.
Mm-hmm.
One exercise in the book is called the possibility panel, and it's about just if you took a second and thought, who are four people that you would want to consult to weigh in on whatever it is that you're facing in your life? People you know, people you don't know. you know, it could be the Dalai Lama. You'd like to have that perspective, or Oprah, or, you know, a wise mentor, or, you know, a grandparent. And of course, it's us, you know, we're doing that work of stretching. But again, back to that idea of what gets us out of the corner is seeing possibilities that when we look at our situation from different angles, we immediately feel more hopeful. We're more, you know, ready to move. So, you know, I really encourage people to just take a sticky note, write down four names, put it on your computer monitor, and the next time you're feeling kind of stuck, just look at that picture, look at that list, and think, you know, what would those people advise me? And suddenly you're just, it's like the air has changed around you, you know.
Yeah, because I do believe most of the time we have the answers inside of ourselves if we can just get out of our own way.
Exactly. And this is, that's a great way of thinking about it. And this is just, that's sort of a, you know, a side route to get to our own wisdom.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And step four, mobilize, you say, mobilize. Don't just stand there, do something. Once we've figured out what the problem is, take action.
Right. And the thing that often stops us, Vicki, and you know, I think we can all relate to this, is that we may know, you know, we want to grow, we want to, you know, we want to create the life that we want. Oftentimes our expectations or our goals are just too big, and then we frighten ourselves again because we think, oh my gosh, what if I can't do that? I can't do that. The alternative there is see that one goal as really a series of maybe five or six goals. So break it down. Smaller goals mean that you meet those goals sooner, you start to create momentum, and then you're more willing to take the steps, and then you have that good momentum going as you complete them.
Right. Now, just, I mean, I know people, and I'm sure you see this a lot in your practice, who say, oh, I'm just a worrier, that's just the way I am. But we can change, can't we?
Absolutely. So you were talking about neuroplasticity earlier, and, you know, the wonderful discovery. It seems kind of funny to say this, but science had us thinking that we stopped developing, you know, in our 20s. That was the end. Whatever, good or bad or indifferent, whatever you had at that point was kind of it for life. And what we know is that the brain is always changing in response to what it practices. And so as we practice shifting out of worry mode and into that, you know, more accurate, reasonable thinking, that becomes a new pathway. And mm-hmm. the more we head down that path, it's sort of like a path through the woods, but over time, if we really keep going down there, it'll get paved.
Right.
It'll be more like a super highway, you know, we will have those connections. So then it's not so much effort for us, though that good thinking comes and meets us halfway.
Right. So just practice. Now, for everybody, I mean, different levels of anxiety can adopt different levels of anxiety, but for some people it's much more extreme than others. When do you know if you need professional help, or if this is something you can work through, say with the help of a book like yours?
Yeah, that's a really important question. That for people for whom anxiety is not just happening in response to a stressful event, you know, a big presentation at work or a party or a, you know, a doctor's visit or something. But it's really something that they wake up with, that they go to sleep with at night, that the anxiety has taken on a life of its own and doesn't need anything to trigger it. It's just, you know, you wake up with this laundry list of things that could go wrong, and that it starts to interfere with your enjoyment of life. You know, maybe you're avoiding things, or if you're not avoiding them, you're kind of just getting through them with a lot of anguish and suffering. There, you know, those are the red flags that it's time to get professional help. And I just want to say that, you know, the really good news about anxiety disorders is that they're the most prevalent condition, psychiatric condition, and they're also the most treatable. We have such effective ways that are relatively, you know, short-term, often treatment is just a couple of months or a few months, and really effective strategies to change your relationship with how you are seeing your worry.
Right. And I read this in several studies. I saw it on your website, too, that cognitive behavioral therapy is probably one of the most effective treatments for anxiety. It says here that it's more effective than a placebo-controlled sugar pill or analytic therapy and can even be more effective than medication for anxiety. So is that a place you recommend people start with cognitive behavior therapy if they need more help?
Absolutely. It's very practical. Patients really like it because it's not, you know, let's go dig into your past and see why you are this way.
Right, right.
It's really about these, you know, this is why, let me teach you about your brain. You're fine. You're going to be fine. This is what's happening. If you understand kind of behind the scenes in the brain what is perpetuating these feelings and reactions, then you know the things to do to change it. And you walk out of session with, you know, small, easy to apply assignments or challenges that will help you. You know, you feel the results of those changes very quickly because you're changing how you see, how you think about situations and how you respond to them.
Well, that's great information, a great book. It's called Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. Dr. Chansky, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
It's been great talking to you, Vicki, and I would just say, remember, we always have a choice. We don't have to get dragged around. We're consumers. We don't have to go with the first bid on our life situation. We can really persist and come up with other more accurate takes on what's going on in our lives that will help us not be afraid to live it.
I like that. We don't have to go with the first bid on our life situation. I like that. And listeners can find out more about you at TamarChansky.com, correct?
Or do you have That's any? Correct.
Okay, TamarChansky.com. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Chansky.
Oh, thanks so much, Vicki. It was great talking to you.
And Dr. Chansky's book, again, is called Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by environmental correspondent Julia Whitty, and we'll be looking at the fate of our oceans. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do you have a writer in your life or someone who wants to write but needs help? Give the gift of creative coaching to encourage their passion this holiday season. Vicki St. Clair has been writing professionally for more than 15 years. She can help jumpstart new writers and unblock experienced writers. Each program is tailored to suit a writer's individual needs and can be a single, one-off consultation or multiple coaching sessions. Vicki can also help you navigate the publishing world and explore ways to make over six figures a year with your craft. See more about Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com. For creative coaching details, call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Or email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. What does it take to be a successful comedy writer in a tough, male-dominated business? Chelsea Lately writer and Roundtable regular Sarah Colonna joins Vicki to tell you how she pursued her dream and share her take on love and life in Life As I Blow It. Please join us next Monday at noon Pacific. See more at conversationslive.net and get updates by following Vicki on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Baby, we'll turn out all right. Baby, don't worry.
And welcome back, everyone. My next guest is Julia Whitty. She's an environmental correspondent at Mother Jones and a blogger at The Blue Marble and Deep Blue Home. She's a former filmmaker with more than 70 nature documentaries under her belt. They were aired on channels such as PBS, Nature, the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, Outdoor Life, and the list goes on. They were broadcast worldwide. She's on the board of advisors of Blue Voice. And Julia Whitty is also the award-winning author of The Fragile Edge, Diving and Other Adventures in the South Pacific, and a story collection called A Tortoise for the Queen of Tonga. Her latest book is called Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. Julia Whitty, welcome.
Thanks, Vicky.
Well, you've got such an interesting background that I'd like to start with that a little. I read that you were born in Colombia. You emigrated as a child to the United States with your Tasmanian father and Anglo-Indian mother. And your father was very much a sailor, which is, I'm guessing, where you got your love of the ocean from.
Yeah, I got it actually from both parents, but my dad grew up in Hobart, pretty much on the water there in the river, and sailed and taught me to sail as a kid. And my mother, growing up in India, actually spent some time, she was on the Bay of Bengal, and so that was the place that she associated with relaxing and rejuvenating was going out to a coast. So I got it from both sides.
Yeah, I personally, for me, the ocean is the place to relax to. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, so you've worked on all these documentary films. You've always been a deep sea diver, as I understand it.
I've been diving for like 30 years now. So I mean, my adult life, I have done a lot of diving, and I did a lot of predominantly underwater type documentaries.
Mm-hmm. And so you started out as a scientist and then got into filmmaking. Is that how the journey went for you?
Yeah, I started out in science and interested in learning about science. And I realized that field science, where you tend to get tied to one place maybe for your whole career, that happens to a lot of scientists, that wasn't maybe the best suited for my personality, and I was a little more restless, and I also wanted to communicate, I guess, I was always interested in communicating to a broader audience, so,
right.
I moved into the filmmaking side of things, and then eventually into the writing side, which is where I am now.
Right, and this book that I have in my hand, Deep Blue Home, it's an intimate ecology of our wild ocean. This is the story of, well, you tell us in your own words, but it's a story that happened in the 80s, and this was a field research project.
Yes, and that's only the first part of the book. It takes place on one island, right, in the Gulf of California known as the Sea of Cortez. It's a little bird breeding island, and it was really very foundational experience for me in that it was the first time I really went from, the urban, suburban upbringing and life out back to the wilderness, and I learned to relate to the wilderness. I formed my first intimate connection with the wilderness, and it formed my life. Every decision I've made since then came from the desire really to have more of that relationship and to understand it and to deepen it, and that led to, of course, wanting to protect the wild parts of our planet. So I refer to it as my first homecoming to the planet where I was born, was arriving into this wilderness and getting back into those rhythms.
Right. And so what made you want to write this story so many years later?
Well, I was telling this book, I'm telling a big, in my mind at least, a big sweeping story,
right,
of the ocean. And we understand now in biology that it's one world ocean. It's connected by very deep currents that flow around the globe, and they move water from one ocean basin to another over the course of thousands of years. And I wanted to tell this big story in personal terms with my own experiences. So I began where it began with me, really, on this little speck of a bird breeding island in the middle of the ocean. And then I go on to other parts of oceans where other issues or knowledge was important either for me to learn or where we have learned, humans have learned, important lessons. I move on to the Atlantic cod fishery and so on. So there's a lot of traveling through different places.
I love that you wove classic literature almost throughout this too, with looking at some aspects of Hinduism and behavior of the Greeks, and you kind of wound it into where we're at today.
Yeah, because I'm interested, I'm really interested in how we relate to these places and how we've related in the past, and what are the messages that we can hear echoed from history of what we maybe understood better than we do now. I mean, science only in the 20th century came to realize that all these ocean basins are connected in one world river. But in fact, the Greeks knew that. They had a god called Oceanus, and he connected the whole, he was a connection of the ocean river and the atmospheric river as one being. Well, this is incredibly, it's taken us a long time to come back to that knowledge.
It has, hasn't it? And there's also a little humor in here. You talk of, you know, you're three women on this island, you're celibate, you stopped shaving, you made use of the peroxide that was there. I mean, you had some fun along the way as well as discovering scientific findings.
Yeah, I talk about the fact that it was our first chance as three young women to really experiment with who we could be or were in the absence of anyone else but the three of us. And it was really fun to sort of be freed of societal expectations and to basically discover our more feral selves. I think we all learned a little bit more about that living there.
So I want to look at a blog post that you, and I know you've done other work on this too, but it was called Unprecedented Ocean Acidification Underway. And this just came out on March 2nd. And you start by talking about coral reefs and how at risk they are from an acidifying ocean. So this was a new study, I understand, from the Journal of Science. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, just to bring your listeners up to speed in case they aren't, so this is the biggest problem that we're facing now in ocean and even climate sciences, is this realization that's only come out of science in about the past decade, that all of these atmospheric emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are being sequestered or taken up by the ocean. And until about 10 or 15 years ago, scientists were like, wow, that's a good thing. We're glad the ocean is taking care and sort of scrubbing all the CO2 out of our atmosphere. And it's only in about the last 10 or 15 years that they've begun to examine, well, what does that mean to the ocean? And what we've discovered is actually extremely alarming, one of the most alarming findings, really, of our environmental consciousness, that this taking up of about a third of our atmospheric carbon dioxide emissions is fundamentally changing the chemistry of the ocean. And that's amounting several steps down the line to an acidifying ocean. When you have an acidifying ocean, and we can look into the geological record and see many times in the past where we have had acidic oceans, and we know that so much of marine life, which needs to make bones or shells or reefs, they can't do it. The chemistry is just tweaked over enough that they can't get access to the carbonate ions in the ocean, because there aren't as many anymore in an acidic ocean, and they can no longer build bones and shells and reefs.
Yeah. This is interesting as well. You say that the world's oceans may be acidifying faster now than at any time during the four major extinctions of the last 300 million years.
That's what this new paper in Science came out with. It's really rather startling. The first people to really dig far back into the record and really assess the rate and the speed at which this acidification was happening and the rate at which marine and even terrestrial extinctions correlated with that acidifying ocean. And their findings are that what is underway right now is happening faster than any of those, and some of those were all extreme extinction events where you had massive die-offs in the ocean and frequently large to massive die-offs on land as well.
So why is the ocean becoming more acidic?
It's due to these carbon dioxide emissions. It's, again, our bad greenhouse gases. So, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, CO2 in the atmosphere has risen about 30%. The ocean has sequestered about a third of that, but in doing that, it has made the ocean more acidic. And right now, as a result of that increased acidity, there are about 16% fewer carbonate ions in the ocean. But as I mentioned, without carbonate ions, so many creatures cannot. But one of the more fundamental things that is really probably one of the more scarier aspects is some of those creatures that cannot make their little carbonate shells are types of the bottom of the food web, the primary producers, the marine phytoplankton. So certain types of marine phytoplankton actually have little shells that they build. Well, you know, the marine phytoplankton, those little plants, single-cell plants in the sea, they make about 50% of the oxygen that we breathe in our air. So we need that incredibly diverse, rich phytoplankton producers working in the ocean, doing things we haven't even been able to do on a village scale yet, namely turn sunlight into energy. That's what they're doing all the time. And now we're changing the ocean. We're already seeing really alarming declines in phytoplankton populations worldwide.
Wow, wow. So as the acidity rises, the infrastructure there declines. And I read also that acid oceans are also noisier, which create a whole other set of problems.
Yes, there's so much, like right now, it's difficult to stress enough the amount of scientific energy that is being focused on this problem. So you can take a look back at the timeline of history and the questions that scientists choose to investigate. You know, we had a huge blip in the beginning in about the 90s where virtually every science, so many scientists turned their energies to investigating questions of global climate change. Now we have so many people looking at how that's going on in the ocean, because we originally only investigated what that meant for the land or the atmosphere. We understand these two are completely coupled. The atmosphere and the ocean are utterly coupled, and everything that happens there will change what happens on land. Mm. So there's so much that's being investigated right now. We're finding that, for instance, in the ocean, things happen more through the chemistry of smell and taste, as well as sound. And sight is very minimized as an important sense in the ocean. And what we're finding is, yes, acidic oceans have the ability to be noisier. They also, we're finding now, masking the abilities of things like larval fish to detect their predators in a more acidic ocean. So they don't get it anymore when a predator is coming to eat them.
Because they can't smell them. They can't smell them.
Yes. Smell and taste is kind of the same thing in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And then they also lose their ability to navigate, and they cannot find their way home again, which is something that many animals in the sea do via this sort of smell and taste sensation.
Mm. Now, we had an incident, I can't remember if it was Saturday, actually, but we had an incident up here in Everett where boat captains, fishing boat captains or tour boat captains, and the Mukilteo ferry captains complained that they heard sonar pings. And it was apparently the Navy testing sonar in port in Everett. And there were concerns around that because apparently in 2003 this happened and it caused orcas to act oddly and there were fatal strandings. But of course, we've got the gray whale migration going on right now. So what kind of concerns do you have around something like that happening?
Well, there is an increasing concern about the amount of noise that we are putting into the ocean, not only from the really, really heinously loud noises that we're doing now with sonar for military purposes, and also for the same caliber of sounds are being used for deep sea oil prospecting, oil and natural gas prospecting. These sounds are louder than any other sounds ever produced on Earth, and we do really have just increasing evidence that they can be fatal to marine mammals, and who knows what else. So there's also, you know, the increasing issue of just more noise, period, in the ocean. We know that the amount of boating and shipping traffic now is big enough that it begins to have an urban effect on wildlife that we've begun to study and understand on land. We know, for instance, studying urban populations of birds, that they will change the frequency of their songs to combat the background noise of traffic. So they will cut out the high-frequency sounds because they just don't transmit through all that din. Wow. And they drop down and have a very simplified song at a lower frequency. So these kinds of things, there is concern that, for instance, the great whales, many of whom possibly speak to each other across vast distances, perhaps even on the order of ocean basins, where they communicate with their kind, maybe that these kind of communications could be increasingly disrupted by the type of sound that we're polluting the ocean with.
Mm. And I saw that whales are already impacted by military sonar. It can affect whale behavior up to 300 miles away. And with the acidification of the ocean and it getting noisier, that's going to obviously increase rapidly, or the distance is going to become greater.
Well, these are the problems, is that we have, you know, we have these sort of evil synergies setting up where, you know, you have one problem, but it's interacting and actually amplifying another problem. Those are the concerns, that the level of things that we're doing in the ocean. You know, we've slowly but methodically come to understand our impacts on the land. And, you know, it's not without a fight, but we do make improvements, and we do fight for things, and we can sometimes win to preserve things and save things and consider other living beings other than our own, exclusively at least. And we're just farther behind on ocean, have less understanding of it. There's a tendency to it's out of sight. It's, to most people, it's invisible. Mm-hmm. And so we're about 50 years behind our thinking. We're 50 years behind everything. The percentage of protected marine lands, marine waters versus protected terrestrial lands, all of these are, you know, like half a century behind. And we are catching up now in the 21st century as we recognize that we can't ignore the ocean. It is a planet that should have been called ocean. And it is the major, you know, modifier and everything on this world that we live on. And we need to take it into consideration. So scientifically now, we're much farther ahead than we were, but we're kind of still awaiting the enlightened action to follow on the heels. It always goes that way.
Right,
Not the first time, but
right.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to look at some possible solutions. And I read an article that said eating more anchovies might help us. So we'll find out more about that when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Julia Whitty, environmental writer. Her book is called Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. Please stay with us.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, we're talking in this segment about the state of our ocean. My guest is Julia Whitty. She's an environmental correspondent at Mother Jones. Her book is called Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. And we were talking before the break a lot about the acidification of the oceans and the dangers that that brings with it to the structure in the ocean. But I wanted to look about how is this affecting. How is this affecting fishing, Julia? And what's changed over the last few years with fishing? Because I know so many fish are lost in those huge trawler nets, and there's been work to try and stop that and modify the equipment that they've used so that there's less damage done.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the biggest picture, what we're really seeing now is for the first time we are beginning to address the idea that we have an exhaustible ocean, not an inexhaustible ocean. And that's a huge shift in human perception. And so we're beginning to tackle that. We're seeing new attempts, not only at nations governing their own fisheries impacts, but international agreements to govern fisheries impacts. And this comes more or less on the heels of really having reached peak fish. So we reached peak fish in the later part of the 20th century. The numbers are argued a bit, but where despite more intensive fishing efforts and better technology, we could not bring in more fish. And we also see a shift now, not that there isn't a lot of wild fishing still underway, but we see a shifting towards aquaculture. There are pros and cons to this as well. But we basically are grappling with this notion that we cannot take everything that we want out of the ocean, that we have to be smarter than that, and we have to use sort of scientific planning, and we have to enforce what we regulate. So that's the big shift that we're seeing, and it's a tough one. It's hard work. A lot of this fishing activity goes on out of sight, way out in the ocean. You have lots of pirate fishing vessels that are just not operating under any restrictions, and these kinds of things are going to be a big challenge for us as a species to be able to tackle these scale of problems. But on the positive side, we are thinking about them, and we are really attempting to solve these now.
Right. And I said tongue-in-cheek before the break that maybe eating more anchovies is one way to help preserve our fish population. But the reason being because we go after the top predators in the ocean, the tuna and the swordfish, and we wouldn't, as you point out, go out into the jungle and eat the top predators in the jungle. So we maybe need to look at us as consumers modifying our diet, and what we require can maybe help long term.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, we can affect to some extent the market by our choices. On the other hand, there is an equally strong argument against eating anchovies, the reason being that the studies of these so-called forage fish, which are what anchovies are, and sardines and herring and things like this, these are fish that are in often the most delicate ecosystems, and scientists refer to them as wasp waste ecosystems. If they're pinched, if you were to look at them, in at the waist, and that's the forage fish.
Julia, could you just repeat that last bit? We're having a little connection issue there. I missed the last bit there.
Well, maybe I'll simplify. So the anchovies and sardines and fish like that, which we're moving increasingly towards eating, there's also a lot of concerns that these are some of the most delicate ecosystems in the ocean, because they are the primary feeders of everything below them, the zooplankton, and they primarily feed everything above them. So they're this little bottleneck in a way. You have huge populations of anchovies and sardines, but once you overfish those, and we historically do this repeatedly, then they have an incredibly difficult time recovering, more than almost anything else. Now, we've seen crashes in California sardines, Peruvian anchoveta, Japanese sardines, Namibian sardines. Some of these have never recovered decades later. So these are really, really delicate ecosystems, and I caution people to just start eating those. The way I've come around to thinking about seafood, as it's called, or eating from the sea, is we are eating wildlife. no matter how you describe it, we are eating the wildlife of the sea. And most of us don't feel good about eating wildlife of the land. Not all of us, but many of us don't. But we still don't see what all these fish are in the ocean, and they are our biggest collection of wildlife left on this planet. So that's the way I've come around to thinking about it. And I think that's something maybe we can think about when we consider our own personal choices.
Mm. So I read an article about dead zones, and why are these increasing so much? Is this part of the acidification of the ocean?
There's different reasons for dead zones forming, and some of them, like the one off the Pacific Northwest, off Oregon, may be a result of climate changes in the ocean. It appears to be where you have changing currents, you have diminishing oxygen levels. So dead zones are a result of dwindling oxygen levels in the ocean. In some places, they fall below where life can be sustained, and those are called dead zones. Most of the dead zones of planet Earth are at the down end of rivers, and they're directly a result of, for the most part, the way we fertilize the land to grow our crops. Well, those fertilizers wash off the land, they flow down the rivers, and they come out into the ocean, and they do exactly the same thing in the ocean that they do on the land. They fertilize or over-fertilize the plants of the ocean. What happens is we get massive plankton blooms of phytoplankton, and so big that no one can eat them and keep up with it. They die, they fall to the bottom, and then the decomposers who come in to eat them use up all the oxygen in the ocean. And you suddenly have this huge area, some of them are massive dead zones, where it's as if somebody sucked all the air out of the room and literally life suffocates or flees. So this is a growing problem, and it's a case where we are in the sort of a conflict with what we're doing on the land and the effect it's having on the ocean. And these are also other issues we're grappling with. Can we modify some of the agricultural practices? And, you know, scientists have been looking at these questions hugely. And in many cases, the modifications can be really rather small, and they wouldn't necessarily even impact economically the agricultural activities. But it's very hard to get people 2,000 miles away in Minnesota or Iowa to think about what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. And I think anyone listening to you now, reading your articles, reading your book, Deep Blue Home, you can't fail to see just how delicate this balance is. You just mentioned the Gulf of Mexico. So let's just touch on that very quickly. And then I want to look at, you know, what we can be doing ourselves. But I was shocked to hear this, that even before BP, even before Hurricane Katrina, it was one of the most toxic coastal pieces of water.
Yeah, the second biggest dead zone on Earth is a seasonal dead zone that sets up every spring and summer in the Gulf of Mexico at the downstream end of the Mississippi River. So our breadbasket of the Midwest is destroying the ocean at the far end of it. And, you know, this is the best-studied dead zone on Earth. Scientists have very, very clearly put up recommendations for what could be done to really mitigate this and really close off the bad effects and minimize that zone. We haven't really had any action on it yet, and yet it could be done. So here it's a case of political will is needed.
Mm. So we've got about 30 seconds here. What could I be doing myself? What can we be doing?
I think, again, it's looking at our choices and playing them out in the bigger scale. What does this mean if I decide to do this or that? There's plenty of stuff online. You can look at a seafood watch. The Monterey Bay Aquarium puts out an excellent seafood watch. Is that the right seafood? If you're going to eat wildlife of the sea, which one should you eat?
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. And the best place for people to, if you just Google Julia Whitty, she'll pop straight up. Her website is under sites.google.com, site Julia Whitty about. So Julia Whitty, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
And Julia's book is called Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. And again, just Google Julia Whitty, and Julia and her work will pop straight up. Some really interesting and valuable information there. And something we all need to be concerned about. I thank you for being with us today. If you have questions on today's show, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net or at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617. Thanks for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.